I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Eileen Miles is the plain-spoken poet of Identities Unbound. She was four decades in the left lesbian underground, the hidden years, as she can laugh now. Today, suddenly, Eileen Miles is as hot as a poet gets to be, and at the same time, she's the multimedia messenger of a transgendering turn in the conversation. In the Amazon video series Transparent, about a changeling family in Los Angeles, Eileen Miles is venerated as prophet and icon. But it's the culture that's changed, not the trim, tomboyish, open, contentious, and good-humored poet from Arlington, Massachusetts. "I'm the talent," she crowed on Twitter the other day, walking into a big hall at Harvard, about to unpack the Times and her own story.
"I'm already totally self-conscious about what Boston accent to have or not have, or I'm already imitating me."
Eileen Miles' first crossing four decades ago took her from working class in Arlington to climbing class in Harvard Square.
"I was born up the street at Mount Auburn Hospital. My dad was a postal worker at Story Street in the square. And I worked in my Catholic school uniform in the 60s at the Harvard Coop when they sold ties and stationeries at the front. And all of that defines me as a townie, a word I think people outside of Boston may use, but I think it's mostly a Boston thing."
She's going to talk with us about that Boston accent, which may be the city's major export, she says, and to the poet's ear, it is no joke. When she speaks of herself as a warrior from the other side of the hill, she's honoring the bohemian poets who lived on the back of Beacon Hill in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. John Wieners is her local hero to this day. His sound is still instructing her.
"My mother, talking to strange men on the subway, doesn't see me when she gets on at Washington Street. So I hide in a booth on the side and watch her worried, strained face, the few years she has got left, until at South Station, I lean over and say, 'I've been watching you since you got on.' She says in an artificial voice, 'Oh, for heaven's sake,' as if heaven cared."
As if heaven cared. In a way, that's my whole talk right there.
We're picking up the thread in my house on the flat of Beacon Hill this week.
I mean, I just think that voice and sound is the 3D of poetry. You know, I mean, the point about poetry is that it's live or lived, that a mortal person wrote it, you know. And one of the best demonstrations of that ever is when the mortal person who wrote it reads it, you know.
"Why would I care?"
Right, right. And it takes so much space and it takes so much time, the care.
But if you're reading that in New Mexico, C-A-R-E, you might miss the whole thing.
You won't hear it. I mean, you'll hear how you hear care, you know, but you won't hear care, you know. I think that's the deal with Boston poetry, if you're writing in that particular vernacular, you know, and I am, and I think there's a history of poets who are.
A John Wieners poem probably ought to have a pronouncing guide with it to get the sense. I mean, the sense of care, but so many things. We're famous for dropping R's, but also for adding them. I mean, Delta Rail Lines. I'm taking Delta Rail Lines and I'm eating a mocha ramen ice cream. It's, you must have done at Brigham's. Henry James actually wrote about the way Boston hostesses will say, there'll be a sofa in your room. But where's to begin in the peculiarities of, you know, corn chowder and all this stuff that is both joke, but somehow, I don't know.
It's joke, and it's funny to think about, why is it joke? Why is it joke? You know, and it's almost like everybody's gotten so self-conscious about it that we now see ads written in a Boston accent.
Wicked pisser.
Uh-huh. But I can't even think of what the words are, but you see it in the subway when they, you know, Havid. They spell out Havid, H-A-V-I-D, to kind of do a send-up. So it's, you know, even taking Boston's prestige spot and running it through the mill of language. And is that for the people who live here for generations, or is that for the people who come here? You know, who is the advertising?
It's different for everybody, but
to?
For most of us, it's about class. It's about standing, rank. With the Kennedys, almost unique sound at some sort of pinnacle. Jim Morris, the impressionist, said he never heard anybody in the world that sounded anything like any of the Kennedys. It was their own
dialect.
Yeah.
Family, or what do they call it? An idiolect when it's a family, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure, because I'm sure they were hanging on to something that was also a piece of political capital.
You also find, though, that it goes back to the 17th century.
Well, that's the story, which is great, that it's like it's English. It's English. It's who came here. I mean, I guess there is a British upper class soft A too, you know, but very much it becomes peculiar in the United States. And so it's what we have. We think it's natural, you know.
Were you conscious of your language, of your sound, your accent when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah, yeah. One thing, because my mother's first language was Polish. She grew up in East Cambridge. Mm. My dad grew up pure Irish in Somerville. And I think there were two parts, they were from two different parts of Ireland, too. So I remember he would talk about H and H. And then I think one of my parents said Jordan Marsh and the other said Jordan Marsh. And I was like, well, which one is right? You know, and then so much of the puzzle, I think, of growing up in Boston and learning to read even was that you'd look at words. You think it doesn't look like what it sounds like. And, you know, like you knew you were crossing a bridge of some sort into writing, you know, because it wasn't what you were hearing.
How did it affect your poetic ambition or your poetic voice growing up?
Well, I mean, growing up, I never thought much about writing. I could write. I loved to write. I kept a diary. I could write poems, you know. And, of course, I grew up in the generation where we recited poems, you know. To a Waterfowl by William Cullen Bryant. Mm. Wither mist, falling dew, well glow the heavens in the last steps of day. You know, and so on. Blessings on thee, little man. They were all guys with triple names, John Greenleaf Whittier, and so on.
It was just Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, of course.
Yeah, every one of them. What was it? I was Helen Gurley Brown. No, there was a woman, I can't remember, Helen somebody. There were virtually no women. And we didn't study Emily Dickinson ever. I think maybe one year there was nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Or however it goes. Yeah, so it was just part of the currency of grade school, at least, to recite poetry and have a relationship to memorization. So it seemed second nature to me to know how to write a poem, and didn't think much about it, you know, until I think college, when I started to write poems in my downtime and distraction became filled with poetry rather than drawing. And then I guess came to it after that in jobs, like we were talking about at Harvard the other day. It was just, you know, like being at the register, having downtime. I didn't do cartoons so much as write a poem. So it just became the kind of the leakage of my brain every day. And it wasn't until I started to write ones that I thought, these are good, that I thought, oh, this could be what I do, you know. And still, I remember being 23 and writing a poem that had the line, because I was driving a cab in Cambridge in my 20s, and not well either. I was not a good driver. I usually had a hangover. It was not a great experience. And I remember sitting outside of a sub shop in Everett, eating a sub, feeling kind of hungover and gross, and then writing a poem that went something like, "Oh life, when do you start?" And writing STAHHT, you know, and just puzzling in that moment, like how to proceed.
You know? That's exactly what I was wondering. When did you, as a poet, realize that the sound of stat with three H's was the core of it?
Well, I think when I got to New York, when people didn't sound this way, you know, and realized, poetry, the poetry world was very middle class, upper middle class. Most of the kids I met had gone to private schools, University of Chicago, Harvard. And, you know, and it was a time when in other cultures other than poetry, it was cool to be working class, like Patti Smith and Bruce Springsteen. You know, it was like they were cool urban kids. And so I remember very deliberately thinking, I'm a cool urban kid from Boston, and I'm keeping my accent, you know? And I even here, when I lived here, I had friends that I went to college with, and we were all locals, and we were all very aware of the fact that we were townies. And there was a sense, mostly with them, that they wanted to kind of make it with guys who were, you know, not from here. And so they were trying to get rid of their accents. And I knew it was a mistake because even at the time, they would have these like Jewish guys who would take them to the plow and the stars, very happy to have like a working class Irish woman on their arm, you know, which for me was repugnant. You know, I just thought that's, you know, like being kind of colonized in this way, you know, as sex objects. But also, you know, part of it was that I wasn't entirely heterosexual. So I was able to hear that from the outside. And I was adamant that I was not going to lose my accent and try and
get such a gutsy move as a young, ambitious professional. I mean, I think I gave up my Boston accent for a girlfriend in high school whose parents came from Minnesota, and I just didn't want to sound, you know,
like a poor kid.
But a lot of people going to New York would have, you know, suppressed it, gotten over it in a hurry.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, I went to UMass Boston, which was a terrific school, but it was a working class school. And there was even a sense there of the value of us as we were, you know, it was weird. There were professors who would make jokes about the fact that we knew so little and we were very exciting to teach, you know, but there were other people who were clearly from working class backgrounds who had made it in the academy and were very excited to be teaching their own. Like one of my favorite professors was from Hunter. And she was totally a working class Jewish woman who got that we were working class Irish kids. And not all, I mean, but it was a very, you know, it was Vietnam vets. It was wives of men who were graduate students at, you know, more prestigious schools. And this was what was left for her to finish college in. She had had a baby and now she was going to UMass Boston. So there was just kind of a very not class free, but it was just, there was no need to change yet, except if you wanted to kind of make it with the private school kids, which that wasn't, I wanted to be one of them, but I didn't want to make it with them, you know?
Eileen Myles made it to the mainstream in the second season of Amazon's comedy series Transparent, about boundary issues in a California family. A political science professor known as Mort has morphed, transitioned in the current word, into the Mora he always felt inside. The actress Cherry Jones plays an eminent lesbian poet modeled on Eileen Myles, and in this outdoor picnic scene, she reads to a women's retreat from an Eileen Myles poem that the real poet likes to read too.
I simply walked, and the apologies kept coming, streaming in, and I said, I simply walked, and the tree turned. No, the key and the bottom of the sea is flooded with light. We just get used to it. The deeper and deeper we go, and the harder it is to
turn the key. And eventually we go, and it is very, very dark. We just get used to the light. But the blues and the grays and the feelings of lostness, it's like home. It's like family.
Coming up, sound and sensibility growing up inseparably in Eileen Myles. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon in conversation with the poet Eileen Myles, a Boston talker of the old school, home to roost and reflect on sudden celebrity in poetry and pop culture. It's worth noting that she did not go Hollywood. The culture came to her and the inner Eileen that she had been searching out from childhood.
One of the ways that they know that the 17th century people were using the soft R is that the language hadn't been standardized, so George would be spelled without an R. And, of course, it meant it sounded like Judge. It rhymed with Dodge, right? And my mother, who is still alive, who is 95, used to make corn chowder, and it was almost an ingredient, the silent R. Like, if I think about corn chowder someplace, I think if it wasn't pronounced correctly, I would think it wouldn't taste the same. I heard a woman say about her friend, there's nothing to her, but of course it sounded like Tua. I thought a whole other gendered sound, and so it's like, there's nothing to him. There's nothing to him. And yet if you want to emphasize it more at the end, you'd say nothing. There's nothing to him. Nothing. Because in a way, everybody's doing drag. You know, everybody is doing their accent really consciously, you know. And so if you really want, I mean, it's like the accent and the absence of the accent becomes part of, like, putting it on, putting it off is how you would put weight on a word and weight on your intention. These are things that are as entirely articulate as expressions, which tell it all by gesture and silence, these shifts. And language is silence, too, and tone.
Speak of just the vernacular in general, which you have so elevated, including the sounds of these poems. And you brought a kind of vernacular crackle back into contemporary poetry that everybody adores.
That's exciting. That's great to hear it that way. Yeah. I mean, you know, I stepped into New York and I had heard of Frank O'Hara. I mean, in fact, I did very little on poetry in Boston before I left. And there was a group that met in the Phillips House in Harvard Yard. And there was a woman who came to that event and she told me about two things, Frank O'Hara and the New York rock poet Patti Smith. And I'd heard of neither of these things. And I thought Frank O'Hara was Frank Harris, the kind of, quasi-pornographer or whatever, My Secret Life. And she showed us to the Habermaster. And I just remember thinking, this is like a prayer. It's like a prayer. You know, I could hear the Catholicism in it. For me, like, I can hear that in O'Hara. I can hear that in Rimbaud. You know, this particular tumble from somebody who's just grown up hearing language be blurred by speed and repetition. And so I get to New York and I step into Coliseum Books and I pick up Frank O'Hara's Selected. And I'm just looking at these poems that were like positively slippery. You know, it was sort of like they were so fast. And I just remember standing in the city and being sort of shocked by the sound of his voice. I mean, I bought the book instantly. I have to have this. It's an elegant vernacular, but it's the voice of the city.
This reminds me of a question I wanted to ask, which was, why is, dare I say, white poetry, white poets, so self-conscious about sounding the way they talk in a way that a lot of black poets are? I mean, thinking of Kevin Young, who throws in a lot of home black language into his poetry, but also just, I suppose, Fred blues Moten. Lyrics in general.
Yeah. Look at Fred Moten, the king of code switching and vernacular, or Simone White, a new African-American poet who's astonishing. It's sort of like standing on your blackness in a particular way, because there was an argument in black poetics, I think in the early 20th century, about don't shame us. Yes. With your, you know, low black stuff, you know, and black poets of any sophistication and any kind of sense of living poetry knew that the language of the streets is the language of poetry. And there was a pleasure in using both and twisting both to say, I'm here and I'm here and I'm here, which is what I do too. And I think the problem for white poets is class, because if you sound working class, then the assumption is you're racist, you're stupid, you're vulgar, you do physical work. There's so many things that get put on you. I mean, I remember when I first came to New York, people literally saying, hey, Eileen, like basically talking to me like I was a thug.
Hey, you from Boston.
Yeah, and it wasn't just Boston. I mean, I've been reviewed as somebody with an outer borough accent. Somebody wrote that about a performance piece. I thought, that's like a really dumb person, you know, because they couldn't even distinguish Boston from Brooklyn. There's a shame, you know, and I felt it a lot with like editors when I do journalism. It's like you fight tooth and nail to do anything that's not conventional English in journalism because they are so afraid that they are not doing their jobs. All the kids with the editing jobs in any mainstream media outlet went to good schools. And they know good English. Mm-hmm. They don't want to look stupid. And so if they let stupid me in writing in some other way, it'll fall back on them. The problem in English is the idea is that we have one class. Except if it's a, what's his name from Scotland, Trainspotting, Irvine Welsh?
Yeah.
Yeah, he can do it. And Junot Diaz can do it because he's non-white, you know? But it's like for white people, you're really risking vulgarity and you're risking being thrown out of the castle because there's hardly a door yet for other white Englishes.
But is that part of the Eileen Miles liberation effect?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's my campaign for sure.
Do your students, when you have them, want to be taught how to break that barrier?
I mean, increasingly students don't want to break any barrier. I have to say, it's sort of like, I mean, it depends on what school you're at. But when I taught in California, I was confronted with a lot of kids from Orange County who went to University of California, San Diego, because they didn't get into Berkeley. But they were good kids and they tried hard and they got great grades. And they wanted me to reinforce the poetics that they had learned in high school that got them into college. They didn't want to hear about, you know, this crazy, dirty stuff. Clearly, suddenly I realized college was part of the rating system to get to the next place. It wasn't an experience unto itself. And, you know, for me, college was like, changed my life.
A lot of this brings us back to Boston, though, because on the fascination of vernacular language, I mean, how many movies have we had now? A lot of them really good. All about the Boston accent. I think of Robert Mitchum playing Eddie Coyle back in the day as maybe setting the high watermark. But Mark Wahlberg and Matt Damon. And
The Fighter was the best.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Mother and the Daughters talking about the girlfriend.
Yeah, well, at last the women have a place, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the endless Dennis Lehane stories, somehow the women don't play too much of a part.
Yeah, Mr. Griver, that had some authentic stuff in it. Uh-huh. Good acting, too, I thought.
Yeah, but it's always pederasty. I'm so sick of his story. You know, it's sort of like, I mean, you know, I'm Catholic. I, you know, went to Catholic schools. It's just like there's other Boston stories than boys being abused, you know. And it seems like it's always in his movies. I mean, he's got an obsession.
And then the Whitey thread, too.
Right, Whitey's the other big one, yeah.
completely booted by Jack Nicholson as a matter of impersonating the language, you know.
Bad, you mean?
Yeah.
Not good. Didn't even try.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I guess he was thinking, I'm going to do the character, not the accent, which is interesting as a thought. But
Robert Mitchum, I never thought he could do that Eddie Coyle line where he's talking about how the gang busted his hand in a drawer, hurt like a bastard, you know. But I thought, oh, yeah, that sounds like us. But the point is only, why wouldn't poets want to be in on this feast of accents around here, which have been so successful in Hollywood, but also tell you so much. It cuts across class and position and violence and poetry, and it's all in that language we talk.
Right.
I'm still wondering if kids say, teach me how to write the way the kitchen table sounds.
Well, I think all you need to do is write. It's like it's not a teaching thing. You already think in that language. I think it's giving yourself permission to use what you have as opposed to using the thing that you learn over here. Like, start with this. I think the great lesson in the arts is to understand that the local and the intimate. I mean, John Ashbery is the most intimate of poets. You know, people are like, I don't get what he's doing. Well, when you read the poem, act like you're in the same room with him. Just take his cues. And you realize it's not abstract at all. It's very, very literal. You know, it's just that people don't know how to be guided by cues and language. They keep being outside going, what is it about? What is it about? Well, what is this about? I mean, we could say this is a conversation about, you know, Boston and accents, but it's a lot about sitting in this room. It's a lot about, you know, you and I with our temperaments and latching on to what the other says as opposed to the question. And, you know, there's so much going on right now that's completely, it's not abstract, it's very literal,
but it's
informing what we're doing.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. Can I ask, this phrase has come out, I don't know if it's yours or somebody else's, but there was an Eileen Miles-shaped hole in our culture.
Yeah.
I think it partly refers to the part in the TV series
Transparent. Yeah. Yeah.
In which somebody very much like you is played reading a poem of yours by Cherry Jones, the great Cherry Jones. Can we talk about that?
This
hole in the culture and
the Eileen Miles shaped
like
hole. The Eileen Miles shaped hole of this moment we are sitting in, you mean?
Yeah. Including Transparent, including the wonderfully ambivalent look of so many people at your reading the other day, a kind of...
The ambivalent look?
Well, that was what struck me as a guy of another generation.
Uh-huh.
This sort of indeterminate gender look is...
Oh.
You look around in that crowd and there are sort of...
Oh, it was mixed. It was
boyish-looking girls and girlish-looking boys, and everybody seems to be happy in what people call the fluid gender
mode. Yeah.
And it's been there. We've always known it was there,
right,
in ourselves or others. But suddenly it is front and center in the whole conversation.
Yeah, which is so great.
The transsexual notion is something we're all having to think hard about.
Well, it's been politicized with such a mundane issue as bathrooms. The funniest thing that I don't know who said this is, what bathrooms do you think they were using already? They're already doing it. There already are trans women using women's bathrooms. There already are trans men using men's bathrooms. I'm using the men's bathroom at Harvard just because it pisses me off, because Harvard just didn't change that yet. I mean, like in 2016, you know? So it's a great pleasure to go into the men's bathroom and shock these guys standing there being against. I'm like, I'm not interested in your you know, that's your problem, you know? You know, so I think two things or three things, right? Of course, Caitlyn Jenner, Transparent, and the politicizing of bathrooms around America have made it, you know. And it's interesting because gay politics didn't have this impact,
true,
you know?
True.
And that's so interesting. And I thought that years ago, I read Jan Morris's Conundrum, and I've been attracted to trans things for as long as I knew it existed. And I interviewed Kate Bornstein in the 80s, and I had a shrink who, it turned out, was about trans issues, and we talked about it a lot. And I identify as trans, but that's a whole other thing. So Jan Morris was intriguing to me because she wrote as James Morris, is the great travel writer. And so she wrote The Great Trans Memoir. And so just the notion of a vastly skilled writer writing about her transition into being a woman was just, is a beautiful book and conservative book, of course. And I went to the New York Public Library when she came to New York to give a talk in the afternoon. And she looks like Barbara Bush, very tall, ruling class, white-haired woman with pearls.
English, of course.
Yes, and British, an upper-class British, And the audience was big and old, you know, the older afternoon crowd of people who go to things at the New York Public Library. And the thing that was so great was that nobody said a word about gender. The performance was complete. It was like people knew, maybe. I think they did, you know, but it just wouldn't ever come up, you know, and I feel like that's how different... When is that? The 90s, maybe? Maybe 2000? You know, just like, she gave her talk, and then there was a Q&A, and not one person said, can you tell me what it's like to being one of the most famous transgender people on the planet? Didn't even make a blip. And now it's such a burning issue. And in between, there was a huge, you know, revolution with gay sexuality and LGBT issues and so on. But it's sort of like the trans one is, it's like race. It's just like, it took us a while to figure out that race was also a white person's problem. That it's not like, we hope it works out for people of color. You know, we're people of color. And we hope it works out for the trans people with their genders. And it's like, gender is everybody's issue, you know? And I think that's what's very exciting right now is, and of course, there's still the micro way in which kids are getting beat up, trans people are getting killed, and race is deeply complicated. But we're talking now, and I think that's what's so exciting.
I'm fascinated that your flash reaction was, it's so great that we're talking about this. But where should it go? Where should we all be taking our multi-gendered heads?
I mean, I think it's like vernacular. I think it's like everybody has the opportunity to be comfortable with where they are or to think about where they would be more comfortable. It's a spectrum. I think there are people who are really gay or really heterosexual, but most people, and really male and really female, you know what I mean? Like, there are people who are archetypes. But I think the vast majority of people are somewhere on the continuum, you know? And it's like, are you allowed to look the way you feel? And are you allowed to act that way? And are you allowed to be loved that way? I think it's just like a vast permission is being extended.
Interesting.
The woman I was dating, Jill Soloway, was interviewed by The New Yorker in the fall. And then she talked about our relationship. And so then they came to me. And then they started to ask me about trans stuff because I'm dating Jill. I must have.
Jill, the producer, director of Transparent, right?
Yeah. And I had met her MAPA. And I kind of stumbled over the pronouns. And I was like, well, he was great. And then I was like, no, they were great. No, they were, you know. And then they were like, how do you feel about they? And I was like, you know, it's not intuitive. It doesn't feel like second nature. And but then I started to think about the line that I had been the most taken with recently in all the world, which is, we are Legion.
It's that opening line in The Demons of Dostoevsky. Luke, your name is Legion, right?
Yeah. So I just thought that that is how...
Right.
I feel, gender-wise, that it's sort of like, there's a girl I lean, there's a boy I lean, there's a, you know, and I thought, no, gender is a multiple. It's always a multiple. It's multiple in me. And since then, I've started to change all my bios to they, because I thought, it might be a little awkward, but every time I read a bio and they're like, and she went to UMass Boston, the she's just like, prick me. You know, I was like, I don't know if I feel like I want to be a girl through my bio. Sometimes somebody gets your bio and they feminize it just because they feel like doing it. If it says she's a member of the New York School, they'd say she's a daughter of the New York School. And I'm like, why are you doing that to me? There's so much pushback around gender all the time, you know? So it's just like I suddenly found, for me, to embrace the they is very exciting, you know, to be swimming in that pool of indeterminacy.
Yeah. It's not just boys or girls, simple binary, but it's still hard to get our heads around that, isn't it?
Well, maybe if that's not what we must do, maybe we don't need to get our heads around it. You know, and we just like allow it to be there and, you know, see what the world does with it.
Eileen Miles missed the blues era in Cambridge clubs of her youth, but she came to the blues in a big way later under Allen Ginsberg's mentoring. At Harvard, she read her own blues tribute titled Harmonica.
Allen Ginsberg wrote late in his life, he was at the harmonium singing these blues songs. We were like, why is he doing that? You know, I'm like six, in my 60s now, I love blues. I'm like, blues is so great. So this is my one, it's called harmonica. I don't want to put my glasses on because I don't want to see. Don't want to move again because I don't want to live. Don't want to love again because I don't want to lose. Don't want to eat again because I don't want to be full. Don't want to drink again because I don't want to feel quenched. Don't want to sleep again because I don't want to wake up. I don't want to live in the summer again because I don't want to be hot. Don't want you to kiss me again because I don't want to be alive. Don't want you to see me again because I don't want to vanish. Don't want to ride my bike because I don't want to get there. Don't want to know my family anymore because I don't want to remember me. Don't want to walk my dog because I don't want to be out. Don't want to stay in anymore because I don't want to be alone. Don't want to be tired anymore because I don't want to feel old. Don't want to eat candy anymore because I don't want to feel sweet. Don't want to talk to my friends anymore because I don't want them to know me. Don't want to sing anymore because I don't want to hear me. Don't want to die anymore because I don't want to see God. Don't want to live anymore because I don't want to repeat.
Coming up, the politics, the presidential voice inside Eileen Miles. This is Open Source. Politics, too, was cooked into Eileen Miles. She can sound like North Cambridge's late great Tip O'Neill, but it's the Kennedy brothers, Jack, Bobby, Ted, that spooked her contrary imagination and may have propelled her own write-in run for president in 1992. This sound is from a video recording by Skip Blumberg at an Eileen Miles campaign event. She's speaking with a certain vigor in a spirit of what she calls energetic despair.
Do you have sound bites that you like to use?
No, I don't. Not yet. I mean, I think right now it's about vision, and it's about talking about what we don't get to talk about and saying the things the other candidates aren't saying and talking about what's silent, uh-huh. You know?
So a lot of people are coming out for you.
Yeah. Energetic despair.
Well, Eileen Miles says she'd like to be president.
Yeah.
I sure hope she gets it so I can sublet her apartment.
I'm running for president because I'm shocked away by my life and yours, and Congress is not. They're bought. The presidency is sold every 4 years. I don't know why they bother. The same people always seem to buy it. Why don't they just admit it's theirs? Let's do something. Write me in.
Got to ask you, because it's a campaign year, and you ran for president in
92. Yeah.
When the alternatives were H.W. Bush, Ross Perot, and Bill Clinton.
Right. And Lenora Fulani. There were actually lots of small candidates that year.
Yes.
Interestingly.
Why did you do it? And what light does that experience shed on the Clintons are still here, but on the choices we're being forced to make this year?
Right. Well, I ran. It came out of a number of things. One was performative. At the time, I was doing improvisational performance pieces. It was the latest gesture on a continuum of being a poet in the age of performance art, reciting poems as a way to kind of enter the performance world, noticing that I didn't have good body language, noticing that when I talked, I did. Watching Karen Finley and Spalding Gray do these beautiful improvisational-looking performances and thinking I could do that. And so doing that for a while, and then the 92 campaign came up, and that was, you know, like at the height of the AIDS crisis and, you know, and George Bush making speeches about the politically correct. He appropriated that language for the first time and said that the real danger to freedom of speech in America was the politically correct, and he meant minorities, activists, people of color, feminists, anybody who deigned to complain more than once, you know, and ACT UP, of course, was having great success with complaining more than once, you know. And they said in the Times that this was the beginning of the 92 campaign trail and the big issue would be freedom of speech. And when I read that, I just had one of those light bulb experiences. I just realized that at 40, I, like JFK, would be a young presidential candidate. You know, I looked into how I could do it legally, and it turned out that write-in was the only way to do it. And that if I performed from April 91 until November 92 as a candidate, I would be able to make speeches. I would be able to represent queers and women and artists making under $50,000 a year. Taxation without representation is tyranny, right? What we grew up with. So for today, I mean, I guess what's so interesting is I have to say, I look at Sanders and I think, I mean, I was a very good candidate and I had to decide that if elected, I'm not kidding, if elected, people were like, are you kidding? And I said, no, I'm not kidding. If elected, I will serve. I will serve the best of my abilities, you know? But I knew in my gut that I wouldn't get elected. And when I listen to Sanders make speeches, I have to say, I just think, I don't believe there's really a plan. Like, it's like, you know, free school for you. I just feel a guy of my generation playing to the crowd and having his sort of 60s dude rock star moment. But he's not going to walk into Congress and break up the banks. I mean, I was just like, come on. You know, like, whereas Hillary Clinton, I think her foreign policy is reprehensible. You know, she stands for so little that I believe in terms of foreign policy, but she is the U.S. government. And that thing that people dislike about her, the flip-flop, she's a politician. I mean, she is, on the one hand, I really dislike her policy on Palestine and Israel a real lot, but she did go to Palestine when she was running for senator. And of course, people went crazy, you know, and she never went back to Palestine. But I just feel like she's such a politician that I feel like she actually could do some things. You know, she is so down with Israel that they could probably negotiate something. Maybe that's deluded, but I just think that, like, I don't want Trump to win, you know, and I don't think Bernie Sanders is going to win. And I just don't really have any confidence in the way he presents. So anyway, so I'm basically a Hillary supporter and I'm fascinated by this election. This is a year to beat all years. You know, I feel like everybody, we're at the edge on so many, you know, like with the refugee crisis, with the environment, with almost every issue, you know, yep. It's so liminal. You know, how quickly will we destroy the planet? You know, here we are, America right at the top of the, you know, sitting in the driver's seat, driving the truck. I'm excited about this election. And even though I think Hillary Clinton is not an ideal candidate by any means. And I have to admit, and I've had wars with trans people around this. I'm very excited about a woman sitting in the White House. It means something to me.
What does it mean?
Walk into any room that has a picture of all the people who ran for president and think about what it would feel like to see. I mean, it meant so much for people to have an African-American president for the last 8 years. It just meant so much. It meant so much that people don't even mention that his political policies were identical to Hillary Clinton's. You know, it means so much to have a woman be in office, to say that the most powerful country in the world can be run by a woman, you know, can be run as badly by a woman as by any man. And so I want to see us have that crack at it, you know.
As a one-time write-in candidate, who would you write in if you had your druthers?
I wouldn't write in anybody. I would vote for Hillary Clinton. Yeah. Because what's the point? I mean, I think it would be very interesting to talking about her getting Elizabeth Warren as her running mate. I think that would be amazing and brilliant, so brilliant, such a concession to the people who really can't stand her. Though Elizabeth Warren also supports Israel. It's like there is nobody in Congress virtually who will stand up for Palestine. And again, nobody mentions that. But I think it's so great because surely Trump is going to pick a man. He's not going to pick a woman. And I think that would be amazing if Hillary Clinton, you know, had the chutzpah to pick a woman.
What was your best moment, your best line, your best talk in 92 as a candidate?
It was in Germany when I said, Ich bin ein Kennedy. That was amazing. And it was just like, I did it a number of times, but I did it once where it was almost like, I mean, I knew I was going to do it, but I was as surprised as they were. And it was an incredible moment of performance. It was really great. I was working with a team of people and we painted right in miles on the border in El Paso when you could still cross. You'd pay a quarter and you'd go across the Rio Grande on a tire tube. It was amazing. I mean, it was just like everything was different before 9/11. If you go to Juarez, you can still see right in miles and kind of peeled red paint. It was kind of amazing. People gave me wonderful opportunities to see what the issues are all over America. People gave me so much. It was pre-internet, and I would just be given literature, given stories. You know, it was an amazing politicizing experience.
Everybody should do it.
Yeah, yeah, I think really? So too. Yeah, every kid should run for president.
Eileen Miles, would you be so kind as to read your I Was Born in Boston in 1949
sure.
poem?
Sure. Yes, yes. I felt we were going there.
The song you have to sing at every bandstand, right?
Luckily, I like it, yeah. An American poem. I was born in Boston in 1949. I never wanted this fact to be known. In fact, I spent the better half of my adult life trying to sweep my early years under the carpet and have a life that was clearly just mine and independent of the historic fate of my family. Can you imagine what it was like to be one of them? To be built like them, to talk like them, to have the benefits of being born into such a wealthy and powerful American family. I went to the best schools. I had all kinds of tutors and trainers, traveled widely. I met the famous, the controversial, and the not so admirable. And I knew from a very early age that if there were ever any possibility of escaping the collective fate of this famous Boston family, I would take that route, and I have. I hopped out on Amtrak to New York in the early 70s, and I guess you could say my hidden years began. I thought, well, I'll be a poet. What could be more foolish and obscure? I became a lesbian. Every woman in my family looks like a dyke, but it's really stepping off the flag when you become one. Well, holding this ignominious pose, I have seen and I have learned, and I'm beginning to think there's no escaping history. A woman I'm currently having an affair with said, you know, you look like a Kennedy. I felt the blood rising in my cheeks. People have always laughed at my Boston accent, confusing large for lodge, party for party. But when this unsuspecting woman evoked for the first time my family name, I knew the jig was up. Yes, I am a Kennedy. My attempts to remain obscure have not served me well. Starting as a humble poet, I quickly climbed to the top of my profession, assuming a position of leadership and honor. It is right for a woman to call me out now. Yes, I am a Kennedy, and I await your orders. You are the new Americans. The homeless are wandering the streets of our nation's greatest city. Homeless men with AIDS are among them. Is that right? That there are no homes for the homeless? That there's no free medical help for these men and women? That they get the message as they are dying that this is not their home? And how are your teeth today? Can you afford to fix them? How high is your rent? If art is the highest and most honest form of communication of our times, and the young artist is no longer able to move here to speak to her time, yes, I could, but that was 15 years ago, and remember, as I must, I am a Kennedy. Shouldn't we all be Kennedys? This nation's greatest city is home of the businessman, home of the rich artist, people with beautiful teeth who are not on the streets. What should we do about this dilemma? Listen, I have been educated. I have learned about Western civilization. Do you know what the message of Western civilization is? I am alone. Am I alone tonight? I don't think so. Am I the only one with bleeding gums tonight? Am I the only homosexual in this room? Am I the only one whose friends have died and are dying now? My art can't be supported until it is gigantic, bigger than everyone else's, confirming the audience's feeling that they are alone, that they alone are good, deserve to buy the tickets to see this art, are working, are healthy, should survive, and are normal. Are you normal tonight, everyone here? Are we all normal? It is not normal for me to be a Kennedy, but I am no longer ashamed, no longer alone. I'm not alone tonight because we are all Kennedys, and I am your president.
Thank you, Eileen Miles. Yeah. That's too marvelous. Really.
It's so fun to read it because it always is different. I always remember different things. You know, it's easy to remember, you know, the AIDS crisis in New York in the this late 80s is when I wrote this. I actually wrote it before the campaign. But the homeless crisis was hitting then, too. There were just so many people living on the streets. There were so many people living in the subway. There were so many people living in Tompkins Square Park. You know, it was just like this massive poverty in New York City that nobody was touching, you know, as well as people dying. It was a deeply politicizing moment, you know, and it was so great when I realized that if I was a Kennedy, I could talk about it.
It's a joy to listen to it from the author. Mm-hmm. Truly, I can't thank you enough. Cool. Also, I got to say, you do look like a Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy, don't mess with her either. I mean, yeah. She's tough.
Yeah, no, I've traveled through a number of Kennedys in my time. Let me read one poem that has nothing to do with anything,
please.
Okay? This is weirdly one of my favorite poems. I mean, not weirdly. I don't know why I say that.
Because you're in Boston.
I knew you would say that. It's weird.
Everything's weird.
What is it? It's kind of weird. Today's kind of weird, right? This is called writing. I can connect any two things. That's God. Teeny piece of Band-Aid. Little folded piece of Band-Aid. I ran to the bathroom to see my face. Sometimes I don't want to see my face in the mirror. Sometimes I can't bear my thoughts. Sometimes I can't do anything. But that's okay. Band-Aid. Book. God. That's right.
Thank you. You're fantastic.
Well, thank you.
This
you
is
too.
My education.
Oh, good. Yay.
I must be living twice,
is the title of Eileen Miles' new selection of poems, as if to say that at a crest of her wave, she's seeing forward and back in the fortunes of her voice and her now digital medium.
At least as a poet, or even as a queer person, I feel like I hadn't found anything or anyone, especially myself, yet when I lived in Boston, you know? So I just was like sort of young and amorphous and full of desire and sort of struggling with the, you know, the whole notion of being from a place and looking at my own and my friends' ambivalent relationships to it. Boston has such a funny, segregated in some ways, and class, and really occupied by so many universities. It's such a kind of educated town in a certain way. Yet it was very hard to find any wiggle room into a poetry world. Part of the problem is if you don't know what you're looking for, you don't know how to find it. What's strange, of course, is retrospectively looking at Boston, there was so much here that I was sitting right next to at various points. But in my head, there was no there there. My experience of Boston, which can't be the consummate truth about Boston, was that everybody I met sort of wanted to be something as opposed to like being it. I met a lot of cab drivers who wrote novels and girls who were taking dance classes, and there was kind of a we're on our way kind of way. And I was like that. And so I kind of wanted to get away from that. Obviously, I have to go someplace else then to get there because it's not going to happen here. And when I landed in New York, I was mostly troubled by disbelief. You know, like I would meet people in my building and they would say, we got a band. And I would like, ugh, band on the fourth floor. And it was like Blondie, you know? So it took me part of my education in New York. And what I really lacked in Boston was this knowing that the local was something, that there actually was something here. My presumption always was that there wasn't. And it's not just Boston, it's everywhere. People don't believe that the local is the thing. They just think that there's some great thing and it's out there. It can't be you. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, the Stein line about there's no there there. The truth more often is that there is a there there, you just don't want to see it. It's sort of like this kind of a, the kind of an erasure that is so increasingly the condition, I think, of how we live.
Back home in Boston this week, Eileen Miles remarked that being lavishly noticed in The Globe, the family breakfast newspaper back in the day, was even sweeter than getting a poem published in The New Yorker magazine. In the age of succinct self-disclosure on Instagram and Twitter, she is both fluent and fashionable.
Tweets is a form. The very limitation of how we use language in social media, or the captioning, is an inherently avant-garde gesture. On Instagram, it's the picture, and now you're captioning the picture. Or in Twitter, it seems like it's the phrase, but you're visualizing. So I think all that kind of movement is like what poets have been doing all along. And I think it's giving us more ways to be out and be part of the culture. And I think it just coincided with some of those cultures, like, for instance, the art world. I don't know, you float in, you float out. You know, it's sort of like, I've gotten so much attention this year, but all those National Book Award wouldn't touch me. You know, because I've gone from being obscure poet to famous poet. But that still doesn't mean that somehow this is an important poet. You're still struggling with the same issues. And that's the beauty. I think you're never winning in all the rooms. The relationship of the small room to the big room is really interesting. And I think it's sort of like, and we all have connections, and it's just a question of, that's like the monkeys typing. It's like, at what moment will all the monkeys start typing you? You know, and one of the poets who had a column in the Village Voice said, his name was Joel Oppenheimer. We don't know who he is today, but he was very famous in the 70s. And somebody said, how did you become Joel Oppenheimer? And he said, well, if you stand around long enough, you're bound to attract a crowd, you know?
Eileen Miles' 1994 novel, Chelsea Girls, and her new and selected poems are both out in new editions from Echo Books. Thanks to Christina Davis and the Woodbury Poetry Room at Harvard for the sound of the John Wiener's poem, also to Bruce Petchek of Seven Generations Video for his recording help. Thanks also to Skip Blumberg and the Media Burn Archive for tape of Eileen Miles' presidential campaign. This week's show was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Abby Duker, and Phil Guerra. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our hard marker. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.